Thanks, JP, for the very generous introduction, and thanks to all of you for coming. I'm having a little bit of an identity crisis at this conference. In part, it stems from the three different names that I have on the three name tags I have. The folder says I'm Brent Rushford. This says I'm... No, the folder says Brett Rushford. This says Brent Rushford. Brett Rushfort. I'm actually Brett Rushforth. But the main identity crisis has to do with the fact that I'm not a historian of France, primarily. I'm a historian of North America and the Caribbean, who is here hopefully to learn as much from all of you as I am to teach. The comments, as JP mentioned, are going to be drawn from an ongoing book project, a too long ongoing book project, this co-authored book with Chris Hodson, Discovering Empire. The subtitle has changed a little bit over time, but the part that hasn't changed is France and the Atlantic World. Now we say from the age of discovery to the age of revolution, although we do start at the Crusades. But our choice to do France and the Atlantic World, rather than to talk about the French Atlantic World, was no accident. Because the book talks over the course of four centuries about what you could imagine as sort of two simultaneous processes. One process we could call the making of France as France. Between 1400 and 1800, I don't think I need to tell any of you that obviously France transforms in very important ways. The France of the Hundred Years' War in 1400, that is characterized obviously by a very small royal domain, a lot of independence, a lot of legal pluralism, people speaking different languages, sovereignties have multiple sites. And it's not that any of that is completely gone by 1800, but certainly it is transformed. The rise of the French state, the integration of institutions, and the movement of populations and goods have made France more like the France that we know today. It's equally true that the Atlantic over this period becomes what could be called a world. In 1400, the four continents that touched the Atlantic scarcely had any connection with each other. Obviously, Europe and North Africa had been interacting for a very long time. But by 1400, it's doubtful that any Europeans had gone south of Cape Bocador and traded directly with the region that would come to be called Guinea, and then the region we today would call West Africa, which is the large stretch of territory from Senegambia all the way over to the Bight of Benin, so around that corner. The question at the heart of the book that Chris and I are writing, and hopefully the question that I sort of invite conversation on today, is what is the relationship between these two processes? In other words, what did or did the growing integration of the Atlantic world shape France? And what was the place of French subjects in the making of the Atlantic world? Or to ask it another way, slightly differently, how can focusing on the French provide us a different lens to see the processes evolving in the Atlantic world? And how can a focus on the Atlantic be more than just France tacking on other people and places, as was discussed a little bit this morning in the Revolutions panel? I'm going to do this for the next 10 or so minutes by delving into one example from the second chapter of the book, looking at 16th century French trade in West Africa. Now, anybody who's taught the Global History Survey or even the Western Civilization Survey, when you talk about 16th century West Africa, it's generally a Portuguese story. We talk about in the 1440s, the Portuguese sent out, under the sponsorship of Henry the Navigator, all of these explorations and trade journeys, and that over the course of the following 100 years, there was a lot of cultural interaction. There were the Lançados, who interacted and intermarried with local African women. And by the time you get to the mid to later 16th century, the idea is Portugal dominates most of the West African coast. Now, in 1562, Martin Frobisher, who is better known for his Canadian discoveries, in fact spent 8 years as a prisoner in the fortress at Elmina. And as he languished in Elmina, he also took careful mental notes, and he gave a detailed report to Queen Elizabeth when he returned. And the overwhelming fact of his experience at Elmina was to recognize that Portuguese presence was really quite weak, even at Elmina, and that the fortress system, for all its ability to anchor Portugal firmly on the West African coast, also anchored them very nearly around the forts themselves and reduced their possibility of trading on vast stretches of the coast. Whereas the English and French ships, he says, traffic along the coasts of Guinea and Lamine, the Portuguese dare not traffic any other place than the said forts. Now, this insight is multiplied by the fact that the coast of West Africa that we're talking about, the stretch from Senegambia to the Bight of Benin, is roughly the same number of miles as the coast of the Pacific from British Columbia to the southern tip of Baja California. And the Portuguese, in the mid-16th century, have about six locations of any size and really only two sizable forts. Now, if you think for a moment about what that means to our narratives of the making of the Atlantic world, it starts to seem a little bit silly that this handful of a few dozen people at a couple of places along thousands of miles of coast could actually be said to be the primary engine of Africa's encounter with the European presence. Understanding the French presence here can help us to break out of that fort-centered, Portuguese-centered narrative. And I'll tell you a little bit about French presence. I can't give all the details here. But French trade on the West African coast, south of the Cape, Cape Bojador, begins as early as the 1450s, and in great numbers doesn't really begin until the 1520s and 30s. But in the early 16th century, there are French presence in places like the modern coast of Liberia, where they traded for pepper, the Ivory Coast, where of course they traded for ivory, and what's the modern Gold Coast near Ghana. It's not until later that you have many French traders in Senegambia. Although in the 16th century, the main Portuguese-speaking community in Senegambia is actually mostly new Christians who have family connections to Bordeaux. Which is a point I'll sort of elaborate on a little bit more later. Just to get a sense of numbers, French trade in the West African coast, by the mid-16th century, there are several different estimates given by Portuguese, Spanish, and English sources. And by looking at those at various times, it's pretty clear that there are at least 200 ships a year on a regular basis going mostly from Normandy and Brittany, trading along the West African coast. Which means that over the course of about five centuries, of course, that's 10,000 ships. Did I do that math right? I'm not sure. I think so. And thousands of encounters, many more thousands of sailors who encounter West African people, who bring back tales of the West African coast. And that for hundreds of these different locations along the coast, the primary West African experience of the 16th century expansion of Europe into the Atlantic was with French traders and not with Portuguese traders. And this overemphasis on forts obscures that. For example, in the 1550s, when the English start to expand a little bit more into the Atlantic, a man by the name of William Towerson, who wrote three accounts of his voyages in the 1550s, the first place he stops is right around modern Sierra Leone. He says, going on shore, I found that the ships of France, which had been there, had done much to hurt our markets. And so he turned home in frustration. The African people who articulated preferences also noted the importance to them of the French presence by giving them alternatives to Portuguese monopoly. He told us, he being this African man who was articulating his preferences, that the Portugals were bad men, and that they would make them slaves if they could take them and would put irons upon their legs. And besides, he told us that as many Frenchmen or Englishmen as they could take, for he could name these two very well, they would hang them. And the African leaders would use this to their advantage. Again and again, the Portuguese complain in their official reports that even at the forts, French trade is siphoning off a lot of the possible trade in gold. For example, in the late 1550s, there are reports from Elmina that something like two-thirds of the gold exports are siphoned off by French traders in this era. One report that's among these, I was quite unable, the Portuguese factor said, to bring the kings to agree to renounce trading. I found out through spies that Dom João, who is a African prince, and his son-in-law and the people of the King of Caman have traded more than 30,000 pesos with the French. Whenever pirates, which is what they call any unauthorized trader, any non-Portuguese traders, whenever they come, they will do this and not forbid trading because self-interest and the profit they gain count for more than whatever the fortress can give in bribes. And so the reports go on and on. One of my favorite is just a frustration expressed tersely by an Englishman who said when he stopped on the coast in somewhere in modern Liberia, he said, "We could do no trade because the Frenchmen had filled them full of cloth." Norman cloth is being traded, all kinds of other European goods. And so by the end of the 1550s, the Portuguese crown had had enough. Jean Nicot, who was the French ambassador to Portugal, living in Lisbon, was actually ejected, and Portugal prepared to go to war with France over this very issue. And the letters that Nicot generates around this crisis that very nearly led to a war at a time when France was really obviously not doing very well. 1559 was a bad year. They lost a king. They were about to lose another. They were at war with Spain in various ways. And Nicot has a way of articulating not only a question about Portuguese monopoly and French response to it, but in fact, he articulates a notion of West African engagement that is much more like the multi-sovereign, multi-site nature of power and authority in France itself. For example, he says it's an incredible thing that they are treated by the Portuguese with such inhumanity and cruelty. This speaking of a group of French traders who had been captured by the Portuguese and were sent to row in the galleys. He said, "This is beyond barbarous," a very pointed and well-chosen phrase. Shifting then to more diplomatic language, he assured the Portuguese queen that he would try to minimize French trade and any incursions on their what they claimed to be their monopoly near Elmina. But in return, Nicot demanded that the Portuguese crown provide a full list of French prisoners and turn all but just a few very nefarious types back that they could then use as examples. The even more interesting thing to me is the way that Nicot articulates the response of the merchants in Rouen. Now, Francois I had indeed signed a treaty with the King of Portugal forbidding French subjects to trade in any territory claimed by the King of Portugal. That included, of course, all of West Africa, because despite them having a very limited actual hold on this region, they claimed it all. And so this treaty, if you take it for how it's written, it actually would exclude all French trade on the West African coast. But voicing the concerns of the French merchants from Rouen, he says that in their name I have admonished the people here, meaning in Portugal, many times, that the same law which presided over the establishment of kingdoms and lordships presided over the commercial exchanges there as well. And that according to this law, navigation was free and all people have a right to trade and navigate anywhere. So this is an articulation, of course, of the right of free trade, the argument of free seas, long before Grotius would articulate it in print several decades later. But what's almost more important than that, or more interesting than that to me, is the way that it reveals that the merchants of Rouen actually suggest an argument about the nature of French sovereignty. They then complain that when the French king made this treaty with the King of Portugal, he betrayed his subjects by taking his interests over theirs, and therefore that made his agreement null and of no effect in their domain. They said all three estates in the province of Rouen are united against him. So what does this mean then? What can we do with these little details? I could go on a little bit more, but I think I better not. With the idea that there are 10,000 French ships trading pepper in modern Liberia, trading ivory in places like Sierra Leone. And if you look to the 1690s, when the French traders get really involved in Senegambia, trading up to 90,000 hides, bullock hides, every year, according to English, Spanish, and French sources. I would want to suggest a few things that might sort of lead to conversation that we'll have together. First, thinking about what this tells us about the emergence of the Atlantic as a world. As I mentioned, obviously one part of this story is to suggest that the Portuguese origins of the Atlantic world, not that it is untrue, but it's insufficient, and that it suggests a very sort of narrow, royally centered, fort-centered view of the West African coast that certainly does not represent the majority of African encounters with Europeans. It's also true that for the Atlantic world, this allows us to see that French trade was much more vibrant than the standard story goes, right? If you read accounts of French colonialism in the Atlantic, it typically suggests they're late to the game. You have some that are involved in piracy in the 15th, 16th, 70s, and 80s. And then it's really not until the 17th century that it gets going. And not coincidentally, this sort of maps on then to efforts by Richelieu and then, of course, later Colbert. And it's a read of the expansion of French colonialism where those two arcs that I talked about actually are simultaneous. They work together. So the growing concentration of authority in the royal domain, the growing elaboration of the French state is, in fact, what actually makes French presence in the Atlantic work and expand. And the degree to which these people in the colonies don't obey the king is the degree to which it can, be said to be a success or failure. I think it's also interesting that this account of the crisis in 1559 provides articulations of sovereignty, articulations of the rights of trade, in the voices of both African princes and merchants on the West African the Western France coast. Well, the Atlantic coast, I suppose, broadly speaking. And that by focusing on France rather than Portugal, we can balance out these voices that are in the Portuguese documents, by and large, talking to Portuguese people about Portuguese trade. And we can hear their understandings. And in fact, one thing we develop later in the book is that these side-by-side trading posts that develop, you can imagine the picture in your mind of 18th century Dahomey, for example, where you have the Dutch and the English and the Portuguese side by side. This is precisely the arrangement that is articulated and demanded by the African princes all along the coast. Well, what about what this can tell us for France? And this is where I have more questions than answers. I think in one sense, it can raise a lot of possible research agendas. For example, what can we really say about the ways in which these regional parlements or regional merchant syndics or whatever syndicates are expressing their relationship to the crown? Now, I know it's a thing that's been investigated in many ways, but not necessarily through these sources. It might give us a new window onto those questions. Another is the wars of religion. One of the things I found is that another part of the standard story is that the wars of religion set France back, and that's what kept them from flourishing in the Atlantic. That they got going in the 1550s and 60s, but then the civil wars kept them from expanding. But the trade numbers actually in the 1560s, 70s, and 80s remain relatively steady. And I found in English archives really interesting arrangements where the crown, for example, commandeers all Catholic ships to fight for the cause. And so all these Catholics are outfitting as Protestants and going to England, where they then quickly shift to different ships and then go to Bruges or wherever to outfit and then leave. And there is a lot of cross-confessional cooperation in overseas trade, even while there are paramilitaries on the ground going after each other's families. And I think that could be a really interesting research agenda as well. Also, when you start to think of the numbers, 10,000 ships, holds full of ivory, skins, gold, there has to be a way to get at these economic effects and the ways in which engagement with the Atlantic world shaped places like Rouen, Dieppe, and others. And finally, I'll just say this, that if we could look at this from the bigger picture, looking forward in time, one of the things I think it allows us to do is to decouple this story of France becoming France and the Atlantic becoming the Atlantic. Because rather than working at the same way or the same pace or the same direction, we often have globalization not going forward evenly. So, for example, the French efforts in the Atlantic are much more global. They're much more connected between West Africa, Brazil, the Americas in the 16th century than they would be in the 17th or 18th century, where merchant companies specialize, where monopolies reduce the sort of areas of ability to trade, and where, in fact, it's the royal efforts to tether all of this sort of protean merchant activity to the state that ends up being sort of anti-global in some ways. It sort of works against the energy of globalizing that had been happening in the 16th and earlier 17th centuries. So with that, I think it's some questions we can talk about, and I'll turn things over to my colleague.